Go Strategic is pleased to present the School of Strategic Living. This is Lesson 13, entitled The Ethical Question by Walter Duer.
We have attempted in our series up until now to define or give a brief overview over the history of philosophy, seeing the rise of man to a central point, even to the point of becoming God, and the decline of God even to the point where he is seen to be the problem instead of the source of all life. We have then looked at the four basic questions, being ontology, the question of where do we come from, epistemology, the question how do we know, axiology, the question what is of value, and then teleology, and have briefly looked at a Christian and a non-Christian answer. We then, in our third lesson, have gone a little deeper and tried to look at the question of ontology. Where does everything come from? And we saw that there are basically three possibilities, one of which can be scratched out very fast. Everything that is comes from nothing, nothing. Nobody in his right mind would adhere to that position. Second position, which is predominantly held by, should I say, lesser intellectuals, people who have learned something at university without really thinking themselves, which is the evolutionary hypothesis, which is still predominant in the institutions and science, but intellectually is no longer en vogue. Existentialism doesn't believe in evolution anymore, and neither does postmodernity. They don't believe in progress. We're not going nowhere. So evolution has become dispensable. There is no real alternative, because the only alternative would be believing in God. So when we say they don't believe in it, we're not saying they have something else. We say they're not spending their life for it, as did modernity, who believed in a progress and we're going somewhere and let's do something about it. So then we looked at that possibility of an impersonal start, which is, again, what most people in the institutions today would hold to. Seeing that we really have trouble defining personality or personhood of man and giving value to man, which helps us to understand a little bit what's going on in a whole abortion fight and in a whole euthanasia talk that will soon reoccur. We then looked at the third possibility, which is a personal start, which we then reversed the equation and tried to look at reality, saying, what in the world is real? And therefore, how must God be who created everything that is real? We looked at infinity being part of creation. Therefore, God must be at least as infinite as creation. Not only in our minds, we talked about the spirit, but not only in our minds, but also in the real world. It must be bigger than what he creates, or at least as big. We then talked about personhood, that which we hold precious. Being Christians, we talk about the image of God in man. Secularized version being the Human Rights Declaration. We then said that we have the one and the many, which is the second big dilemma philosophically, that we don't know how to bring them together, and we human beings, being finite in our brains, have the tendency to either or, and have a tendency to either oneness or monism or plurality, which is postmodern ideology. And biblical Christians hold both to be real, and therefore are not either or, but both and. And here we are, trying to bring those different elements now together as we look at the ethical question, which is on page 5, the ethical question. This is the question about the origin and the nature of evil and suffering, and the theological term, and I'm not sure it is used in the English world, I think it is used, but in the German world, it certainly is, in a German theology and philosophy. The philosophical or theological term is theodicee. That means justifying God. God is under attack. Or to say it in other words, how is theology possible after Auschwitz? How can a God of love let his people die in Auschwitz or in the gas chambers of Nazi Germany? How is it that he lets kids, women, innocent people suffer? Or to say it in other words, if Christ indeed is the Lord of all, and he indeed brought salvation for the whole creation, why on earth are we in such a mess? That's the question. And the technical term is theodicy. Again, I'm not sure how much that is used in the English world, but if ever you have to do with German philosophers or German theologians, that's what they will talk about. This question is, according to one of my professors, I put his quote in here, Johannes Brantschen, the only real serious objection against God. Every other argument against God, Feuerbach, projection, all that stuff is relatively easy to refute. Relativism, relatively easy to refute. I mean, once you're trained in philosophy, let's argue, okay? Here we come to a borderline. That is to say that here we have situations that we really can't explain, that really seem to be strange, if not stupid, from our perspective. Why on earth do innocent children suffer? Why do we have eruptions of mountains that kill thousands of people? And all the saints that happen to be in that area are killed with them. Okay, it's not just sinners. We don't know. And we should be careful with all the arguments that I will give afterwards, not to give the impression as if this is just a matter of logic. For those who are suffering, it's not a matter of logic. It's a matter of pain and of real life. And we should be very careful with our words and with our lives and really sympathize with them and cry with them. I mean, there comes a time when we can't do anything but crying with them. But we shouldn't remain there, of course. We started off this series by saying that all of us have a choice to either eat from the tree of life or from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which basically means the tree of knowledge of good and evil. If I don't understand it, I will not accept it. And therefore, I won't worship you, Lord, because I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And then the question, why, becomes a barrier between me and God. And I refuse to worship him because I don't understand. The tree of life, on the other hand, is the tree where we stand and worship. We said, Lord, we don't understand. It's hurting. Seems to be wrong. I don't understand. Period. I just don't understand. But I worship you. Because I know that the only other alternative would be stupidity or emptiness and total darkness. If you are not who you say you are, then we are in deep trouble. So worshiping you, accepting situations that we don't understand, not blind, not stupid, not call it good, still painful, you know what I mean? Sometimes we go to the other extreme religiously and we praise the Lord for bad things. I mean, praise the Lord anyways or so. Let's allow for real suffering. I mean, there is real suffering in this world. And it's real. It's as real as anything else we talked about it. But nevertheless, I will worship you, Lord, knowing that one day you will wipe away the tears and you will give understanding. And one day we'll have not a view through a glass darkened, a limited view. One day we'll have your perspective and we will see what good can come out of which that which now seems to be senseless. Just a few days ago, we received a call from one of the pastors of FCL in Ohio, who'd been killed by a bus. He was running, jogging in front of his house, bust, overspeeded, that's what I know. I don't know more facts, but he was just killed like that, snap. For breakfast, went on jogging. Family never saw him again. Family of four kids. We'll have some explanation later on. At this time, we just have pain. So with everything I will say, and I will attempt to give some answers, I think we need to be very careful here. This is not a rational or rationalistic effort to put away with pain. You understand? It gives us some understanding, but in the final analysis, it leaves us still with some questions, and it brings us in front of those two trees, where I either bow down and worship the Lord without knowing everything, or I decide that if I don't know and if I don't understand, I can't worship the Lord. Which is basically where most of the world is today. Mm-hmm. Ever since the woman first took the fruit from that tree and the man took it with her afterwards. So, having given this introduction, we now want to look at the alienation of man and the necessity of an ethical response. Most of what we now look at is out of a book of Francis Schaeffer, and if you want to read it or reread it or go directly to the source, you have the source there. He's there and he's not silent, page 21 to 33. Francis Schaeffer, in his book, is trying to define man, and we have already had different discussions around those same topics, so I'm able now to sort of summarize some of the things we have already looked at. Francis uses two terms. He says man is finite and different. In terms of man being finite, we should be positioned now to just understand what we talk about. Man has a start. He is limited in time and in space. There's only one place we can be in one time. By the way, in parentheses, you realize that all created beings are finite. That includes the devil, who is a created being who is finite, which means he is in one place at one time, and that's all. He can't be everywhere at the same time. He travels a little bit faster than we do. He has a little bit more intelligence available, so he can be fast in several places. I mean, but he's only in one place, one time. It's a finite being, okay? We all understand. Say it in other words, we are from the finiteness, the physiological side of things, we are, like the other animals, part of the creation. We all agree with that. It's no problem, isn't it? Up with everything else we discussed. But there is one dimension to man that it goes beyond the physiological, the chemical, the biological. We have already discussed with the picture of manhood or personhood or person that there's something in man that always goes beyond, both in his spirit, in space, in time, backwards, forward, in numbers. We always want to go beyond. There's a drive for infinity, but it's not infinite. It's just this inner drive for infinity. And whatever it is, we were subsuming or calling it a person. We now call it different. Can you all see that? Man is on one hand, I say it a little bit primitive, he's an animal, but he is more than an animal. Okay? He's also an animal. This is the condition. But he's also more than an animal. Are we all in agreement with that? No problem. Okay. Now, looking also at man from a different perspective, not so much from his being side, but more from his doing side. What is he doing? We have two dimensions there, too. Man is able to do wonderful things. He is able to produce art, the most beautiful art we can think of. Man is able to sacrifice his life for others. Mother Teresa has recently been buried and received a state burial for just serving the poor of Calcutta. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and other saints have given their life for others in World War II and many different noble things. So there's something in man that makes him noble, which means he is able to do great and wonderful things. Would we all agree with that? Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have already discussed about the atrocities of the 20th century, World War I and II, Pol Pot, the atomic bomb, destroying our planet, the ozone layer, abortion, euthanasia, betrayal, crime, whatever else. I mean, you name the evil, it's always man that do it. So it's no exaggeration to say man is noble, but he is also cruel. Would that be fair? Yes. So we have a tension there. We're in a real tension. We have a double description of man. On one hand, he is finite. He's part of creation. Or maybe to use a bit more secularized words, he is part of nature. At the same time, he goes beyond nature. He's not just an animal. And on the other hand, looking more at his action, what he's doing, we can say man is cruel, yet at the same time he's able to do wonderful things. He's also noble. All those statements about man are basically true, but they are in a certain tension with each other. How is it possible that educated man, with everything that happened in the past, can be both noble and cruel? And then the question is, why on earth is somebody noble, and why on earth is somebody cruel? And on what basis? Having looked at the ontological possibility of an impersonal start and of a personal start, let's quickly examine those two possibilities with this description of man. If we believe that we have an impersonal start, in other words, everything happened through a natural process of evolution, then we have to come to the conclusion that man is cruel because he is finite. In other words, cruelness is natural to man. It's part of the evolutionary process. To go one step further, there is no such thing as cruelness, because that which is normal or that which is natural cannot be called cruel. So cruelty, in the final analysis of this thing, is just an emotion of sentimental people who would like to have it a little bit nicer. Remember Vuketkis? Mm-hmm. We're just apes that came down from a tree. We killed each other on the tree for food. Why not kill each other now for food or for sex or for whatever else? It's natural. If indeed the survival of the fittest is the key to life, then cruelty is natural. It's part of the process. And Hitler was perfectly right. To say it in other words, we are here on this level, different finite, we are talking metaphysics. Okay, meta, and this is the Greek for physis, metaphysics. We're talking being level. On this side, noble and cruel, we are talking ethics. We're talking doing of man. This is the being of man. This is the doing of man. Now, we think certain things aren't cool. For instance, Hitler wasn't cool. It was a big crime. We think that's true. So we have an inner sentiment or an inner understanding of what's right and what's wrong. We have ethical standards in ourselves. The question is, what is the basis for those ethical standards? And if indeed you believe in evolution, we are basically putting a lot of stress on man. That poor being who just survived because he was killing everybody else who couldn't survive, suddenly should behave like an angel, according to some ethical standards. If indeed you believe in a evolutionary view of life, you have no way to separate metaphysics, being, from ethics, doing. You do what you do because of what you are in your being. It's natural for you. Only if we believe in a personal start, in other words, in creation, in a God who personally created us, only then do we have an opportunity to separate metaphysics and ethics. And I will now prove, or we will discuss this point. In other words, man is not cruel because he is finite, but for some other reason, which we will explore. We can separate metaphysics and ethics. We can separate his finiteness from his cruelness. Did you all understand? We're now building line upon line, precept upon precept. So if I'm losing any of you, hook me in and tell me where I lost you. I want all of you on the wagon here. Are we all together here? Mm-hmm. Only with a personal starting point are we able to separate metaphysics and ethics. And let me explore why this is the case. We basically, today, most of us agree man is cruel, or we could say man has a problem. Most of us at the end of this century agree we are in deep trouble. Postmodernity is the agreement that we are in deep trouble. That no, we don't have our act together. No, we won't build our paradise on this earth. So if there is no sense in this planet earth, let us at least drink and be merry, for tomorrow we'll be dead. Let us at least enjoy the little life we have. So man has a problem. Man is not in a good state. Humanism is dead, to put it in other words. Nobody believes, or very few people, believe that man is good and will produce paradise on this earth. He's produced it in several ways. He tried, attempted to produce paradise, and every paradise became a hell and an inferno. And today, postmodernity is totally skeptical about man's ability to produce paradise on earth. Okay? So that's good. We have a problem. Now, there are two possibilities if we agree that man has a problem. The first possibility is man, as he now is in his cruelty, is what he has always intrinsically been, which is what we just discussed. If how we now are is how we have always been, then there is no hope of a change that we might change in the future. Then this is natural. And then, if this would be true, the problem would be the word cruel. The problem is our sentimental, emotional response saying, well, man shouldn't be as cruel. But there's no basis for that, it's just a wish. So on that basis, we would say, this is the old version, man is cruel because he's finite, and that means he's basically not cruel. There's no such thing as cruelness. We just have sentiments of cruelty, but it's natural. But we're now exploring, with a personal start, that we can separate metaphysics and ethics, that indeed man is cruel, and that means, which leads us to the second possibility, B on your sheet, 2B, man, as he is now, is not what he was. In other words, man now is abnormal, once was normal, and now is abnormal. With this possibility, we can now go down and explore a little further. We can say, well, man changed somehow, didn't he? We Christians, we know this is the fall. Now the question is, why did we fall? How did we fall? And one possibility would be God made us do it, or he made us fall. God is responsible for that fall, which would lead us back to the first opportunity. Man had no hope and no responsibility for what happened. God is in charge. He made it. He made me fall. There's this famous little joke among Christians, the devil made me do it. Huh? Which means I'm not responsible for what I did. Sort of. If God created the change, then we're back to the first possibility, and that means we cannot separate finiteness and cruelness. God made us this way. Which now leaves us with the only other alternative. God did not make the change, and there was a space and time fall of man. Now let's think about this possibility for a few moments. There is a space and time fall of man. That means God created everything that is, and lo, it was very good. Okay? It was very good. Now, if everything is very good, the question then arises, where was evil at that time? Or to put it in other words, God is light, and in him there is no darkness. Is that true? We all believe that.
Yeah.
He is light. There is no darkness. So, what happened to evil? Where did evil come from? What's the nature or the essence of evil? But let us first finish the sheet here and then come back to that one question, which will need a few more energetic arguments and thought processes from all of us. If there was a time and space fall of man, then there is hope for redemption. That means man wasn't always how he now is, therefore doesn't need to be always how he now is. He can be redeemed. Which means the death of Christ becomes meaningful. He can redeem us back to the original intention, without which the death of Christ would be a nice religious symbol, an encouraging, courageous step, whatever else, but never redemption. But if we have indeed a change in time and space, a real fall, then God has created man good and is not in charge for the fall. Even more so, not only is he not in charge of the fall, if he would be in charge, God would be bad himself. If he made us fall, or if he created evil, it means that whatever he creates is part of himself. Then God would be light and darkness, not only light. Now, most people agree with me when I say this, but in the back of our mind, we've never dealt with the issue of evil, and in the back of our mind, we're somehow still dualistic. Somehow, God still has created evil, because he's the creator of everything, isn't there? There's nothing that isn't created through him. And the question is, can we separate metaphysics, the being of things, from ethics, the cruelness of things? If we can't separate it, then God himself is cruel. It's part of his life, which means the term cruel is absurd. Because cruel can only depict if you have something on the other side to compare it with. If cruel is natural in a true sense, then it's just a word, but it doesn't carry the meaning that we now give it. Now, did God create Satan? Philosophically speaking, it doesn't really matter whether Satan was the first one who chose against God or man chose as the first one. It was putting something into reality which wasn't real before. Now, I'm giving you a hint already. Usually we discuss this issue about an hour because I would like to draw out those things that you don't dare to speak out because you know they're not fitting somehow, but they're still back there. So as much as possible, I'll urge you, sometimes with other groups I say, well, don't talk for yourself, talk for your Christian friend. Give me his arguments. That allows you to be freer with things that somehow you know are wrong, but somehow they're still there and they're not coming up. So get them out. Think about the nature of evil. What is the substance of evil? Does evil have existence? If it has existence in terms of substance, of being, then it must be created, doesn't it? If it is created, who created it? Then it was God. That means, and maybe I can draw a little drawing here, for those of you listening to the tape, I'm trying to give a description of the creation account and then the fall. We have creation, and everything was good. Very good, in fact. And then we have an event called fall, and then we have the course of history, as we now know, where we have said man has a problem. And we have many consequences of sin, which indeed are materialized, structuralized. And we have a lot of evil in this world. We have pain, suffering, we have death, we have consequences that are tangible. And the question really is it possible that God creates everything good, and then we have the time and space fall of man, and then we have the course of history, and suddenly we have good and evil. The dualist would say, well, good and evil are two principles that have always been there. Therefore, conflict between good and evil is the essence of life. So, there was no time and space fall. Therefore, there is no hope for redemption. Things are not going to be different in the future because they have always been what they now are. The monist would say, there wasn't everything good. There is no good and evil. Whatever is natural. God made it. Christians profess God created everything good. There was no evil. There happened a fall, and now we have good and evil. But now the question is, what is the nature of that evilness, the being, and how is it possible to keep evilness away from a good God, intellectually, philosophically? In our worship songs, we profess it. But in real life, a lot of Christians, somewhere in the back of their mind, still have a question mark, if not an accusation, against God. Especially, and that's what I said in the beginning, especially if it hits you personally with real life suffering, which we do not want to rationalize away or take lightly. We really want to empathize and want to cry and suffer with people who are suffering. But on the other hand, what is the nature of evil? If it is created, or if in any way God is still in charge, we have to bring it back to the origin. In fact, we have to bring it back to the very essence of God. Let me put the question in your framework. Does evil have a reality? Is it real? Or to use a little bit more a philosophical term, is it actual in its origin? I will try to summarize it for you, and then we'll have more discussion when the tape is closed here. I will try to summarize it. Augustine has said, evil has no existence. This is one answer. It's not the best answer, but it's a good one to talk with. Well, it's one of the best answers. Augustine has said, evil has no existence in itself. Evil is the perversion of the good. If there would be no good, there could be no evil. The best picture to illustrate it is, evil is like a sickness. There is no sickness in itself. Only healthy bodies can get sick, which is a distortion of its health, a reduction of its health. Another analogy, which isn't as good, but it's also helpful. You're aware that analogies always help illustrate, but they have limits. They're not, you can't draw them to the extremes and everything. Another analogy is like with Satan. We think Satan is a big guy, when in fact for God, it's just a little worm, it's no big deal. But we are almost dualistic. We think as if Christ would fight with Satan and have problem with him, you know? He's almost making it. He needs Michael and he needs the two-thirds of the angel to conquer Satan. I mean, sometimes our spiritual warfare thing goes just a little bit too far in terms of as if the two principles would be in fight with each other. That's not our God, okay? So Satan is a created being. But coming back to evil, Augustine says it has no existence in itself. It's only a depreciation, a taking away from that which is good. Which is to say that indeed God created everything good and there was no evil. Now, was God surprised when the fall happened? Woo! Didn't think of that possibility. That would be a naive good God. But because he's infinite, he has the capability to think every possibility. Which leads us to the final statement of our thing. I think you probably had it somewhere down the road. What's the difference between potential and actual? Between potentiality and actuality? God in his infinite wisdom is able to think every potential, every possibility, without ever making it real in himself. There's no surprise for God. The difference between potential and actual is this. This little pen is in my hand. This is actual. This is real. This is reality. Now it has the potential to fall down if I open my finger, which now happened. So now it's no longer actually in my hand. It is actually on the table. It has the potential to go back into my finger if I lift it up. If I don't, it stays there. Okay? It's up again. I put some energy, applied some energy to it. It's up here. Potentially can fall down again. Actually, it is between my fingers. So actuality is real, is reality. Potentiality is not reality. It's a possibility that can become real, but isn't real at this time. So God created everything good, and there was one little tree they shouldn't eat of. Everything else was for free, free lunch, but one tree. This was the tree of knowledge of good and evil, not of existence of good and evil. Potentiality. Was God surprised? Of course he wasn't surprised. And of course he knew in his bigger plan that it needed this little detour, which happened to cost not only a lot of our lives, but his own son's life, that we needed that detour to become mature. But potentiality is not actuality. That's the philosophical answer to the question. Potentiality is not actuality. God created the whole garden wonderful, everything was good, and it had one little potential, one little thing. Some fruit, whatever it was. Leave it there, be obedient, worship in front of the tree of life. Don't leave it there, want to grab it, want to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Two possibilities. Now, why did he have this tree there? If the tree wasn't there, they could have eaten what they wanted, they could have jumped up and down, but could never have fallen. By the way, you realize I forget the serpent? I don't care about the serpent. If there would have been no serpent, it might have happened 2 million years later, but it would have happened. Okay? So, yes, there was a Satan, yes, there was temptation. Who cares? I mean, that's not the issue here. Let me go one step back here. There was a Trinity, as the old theologians say, a sweet community in itself. So much enjoyed they their life, their fellowship, their unity, that they said, this is too good that we can keep it for ourselves. Let us make man in our image so that they in turn can experience what we are experiencing. This is just too good just for us. We have to give it out. Now, they are persons. They are in loving relationship. So that's the nature of God. God does not have goodness. He is good. He does not have light. He is light. He does not have love. He is love. Okay? This is his being. Therefore, he creates a world where love is supposed to be the essence and relationship is supposed to be the essence. Now, my little boy, Oliver, some of you have seen him play football. He's a real rascal. Wonderful little boy. We call him Bear. He's our bear. He's a fighter. There are very few things in life more exciting than when little Oliver runs and gives a hug to his daddy. There are a few other things that are exciting too, but this is one of the best. Okay? But you know what makes it precious that he comes and gives me a hug?
He wants to do it.
He wants to do it, and he doesn't always do it. It's not a robot. He doesn't always do it. Sometimes he doesn't want to give that a huggy. And then I have to fight with my own insecurity and whatever else. Okay? But when he does it, it's heaven on earth. Why? It's with his heart. It's a relationship. It's not an automatic response. It's not a forced thing. He doesn't do it because I tell him to do. Although I tell him from time to time he should do it. But he does it out of his inner motivation, and that makes it precious. What would happen if my little Oliver was programmed give me a little hug every time I come home. Hi, Daddy, nice to see you. Really nice, great. Absolutely meaningless. Can you see that? Only if there's a free response, if there's a real relationship. In other words, if there is the possibility for not doing it, only that makes it real. If you only do not sin because you have no opportunity to sin, that's better than sinning, but it's not good enough. You should not sin, not because you have no opportunity, but because your inner value system says, I don't want to sin. It's stupid to. Or maybe you say, I would like to sin, but it's so stupid, I'm not going to do it. It should be an inside response. It should be coming from the heart. So because God loves man, he creates him with freedom, which alone makes him able to have a relationship with him. If there is no freedom, or to say it philosophically, if there is no potential to withdraw from a relationship, then you are forced into the relationship, which means it's meaningless for somebody who is really interested in a relationship with you. The dictator doesn't care. He just wants the system flowing, okay? But somebody who loves, who wants relationship, he cannot be happy with anything forced. So the only proof is this one little stupid apple or fruit or whatever it was on this tree. If you're not taking it, it shows that you love me. If you want to take it, it shows me that there's mistrust in our relationship. Well, let there be mistrust and let there be outworking of that mistrust. And that's why God allowed that apple to be there. Potentiality is not actuality. God created everything good, knew the potential for evil, although he never knew evil from the inside in his being. It was never actual in God. But because he wanted a real relationship with us, there was the potential. And filling that potential, or bringing that potential into actuality through the fall, through eating the fruit, bringing it from here to here, was man's deed, man's responsibility, and not God's responsibility. And that alone guarantees that God himself isn't evil, and any other theory in between would bring evil back into God.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international non-profit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.